the drinking.
Meant to the drinking. So this is your brain on the future? Is that no? This yeah, it's brain.
This is your brain,
this is
on, the
your brain on the future.
So this is going to be an informal sort of partial discussion, and including questions and stuff. The concept is to talk about sort of what we see and what we're seeing and what is going on in the development and sort of the vectors that are happening in the development of psychoactive drugs, psychoactive technologies, and...
Both in terms of the interest of just the development of the psychoactives, but also what it means to humans to get, in some ways, more and more control over their mindset, their brains, their emotions, and how and what you do with that, and what that means for people.
It's sort of a weird thing with, you know, obviously, just to sort of set the baseline, everyone's going to get on the same page, and everyone's probably thought of all this before, but the, you know, sort of the growing sort of pharmaceuticalization of mind state, that not only, you know, sort of, you've got sort of the development in the 20th century of all sorts of different available psychoactives, but then in the last 20 years, 30, 40 years even, you have this huge expansion in the things that are available to sort of normal people to change how they feel right now. And even over the long term, like the development of the antidepressants and things like that, where not only you're taking something acutely, I would like to feel better right now, but I'd like to feel better in a month, you know? And so I'm going to take this thing daily for a month that will make me feel a little weird for a while maybe, but hopefully sometime 4 to 6 weeks later, you know, I'll be happier with the world. I'll be less irritable. And the nature of putting, you know, it's kind of the self, kind of the recursive problem of sort of what do you do about the fact that you know that you can change how you're going to make decisions. And so the decision-making apparatus is deciding to do things which will change the way it makes decisions. That the future of that is obviously pretty open. I mean, there's a huge development both just in sort of the pharmaceutical world, but also in technologies, the sort of direct brain stimulation and games. I actually think sort of gaming and porn are kind of cutting edge technology developers, and the ways that, like, I'm really looking forward to being old. Not today, but in 20 or 30 or 40 years, being bedridden in 40 years, assuming no cataclysmic, you know, disaster, that I assuming I still have nuclear power plants to power the technology necessary to entertain me, I think that it sounds pretty fun to have full 3D worlds and direct neural stimulation.
And nobody expecting anything of you on a daily basis.
Anything at all.
You can play Civilization
all day, every day.
Right, and when you
with your brain.
Right. Well, and with you, when you get like your towns grow bigger or whatever. When like the you know your area expands, you get a little pleasure rush. Anyway, so there's also the. Like we gave a talk last summer at a sort of, I can't remember what it's called, Future of Drugs or something like that thing in London, and talking about the not only sort of the future of drugs, but sort of future of drug information, that as you know, you have the internet is this huge has had this huge effect on information space, where people are more and more able to post their own stuff, right, and be able to communicate more, but it's going to the point now where people are carrying always on their person communications devices. So we were talking about the idea of sort of people at parties, you know, not only, you know, do you go look up to see if the pill that you bought from your dealer is going
to,
you know, is
known
good,
to be good or bad.
Known to be good, but that you get a photo at the party you're at, you know, here's a picture, here's, I took this 45 minutes ago, it's really good, you know, whatever, I'm at, you know, you do a little search on 16 and Folsom, or, you know, 16, whatever. And
what kind of pills are going around at that party over there? You can get instantaneous response.
The flash mob.
Yep, yeah.
What's
right.
Flash mob?
What's a flash mob?
I'm sorry. Flash mobs, for those of you who don't know, are with the development of cell phones, in particular SMS technologies, you can basically virally spread a message out. And so flash mobs in their earliest incarnations were people doing sort of absurdist things, like going to, for instance, a bunch of my friends went to the Stephen Sydney Opera House and then to kind of the steps in a big row and saying, row, row, row your boat while making a rowing motion, and then disperse again. And these people won't necessarily know each other, but they're doing it. They're just sort of coming together virally because of this.
You get a message that says, come to the city hall and sit down and sing, row, row, row your boat. And,
right.
You know, people kind of show up. Yeah.
Like anyway, so the future of sort of drug information and sort of is potentially sort of everyone is carrying around a recording device which can be, you know, temporally and physically linked to the faith they're in.
Oh, the good LSD right now is at the corner of 17th
right.
and Mission for 20 minutes. If you can get there, you can get it. You know, I mean.
We were just there with our portable gas chromatograph.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That sets out the results. So I think one of the most interesting parts about this for me is thinking about the ways in which you have control. We can predict that as time goes by, humans will have more and more ability to choose to alter their consciousness in very specific ways, and not just in the short term. That in the long term, you can choose. I mean, people now take daily uppers or downers in order to moderate their you know, I'm always a little too depressed, so I'm gonna take Adderall on a daily basis, and that's gonna get me up a little bit. And theoretically, people are making that choice the first time you make that choice, you're making that choice in your natural brain state. I mean, you're there, you are, you're feeling kind of depressed, you're like, maybe I should go on some sort of antidepressant. And then you're on an antidepressant, and now you have a different mentality. People can be very, very different if they're on a daily medication. And now you're making decisions as that new personality, and you might choose to switch to, oh, well, I would actually like to have that be a slightly different antidepressant, you know. And now you're making that choice from not your natural state. Now, I realize
baseline.
That people did not necessarily like their baseline, so that's why they're doing this in the first place, but... imagine a future. Okay, go ahead.
We had a friend who had started taking Prozac. I can't remember quite when Prozac was sort of first on the market, but it was sort of late
80s.
Late 80s sometime. He'd been taking it from the late 80s, pretty soon after it came out, and had never been off. You know, he had been wildly moody and depressive, you know, sort of moody with little, you know, manic depressive, but very short manic phases and long, deep depression phases. And sort of when he turned, you know, 25 or whatever, the Prozac came out, and he was like, I'm going to try it. And he'd never been off. And he was a fairly successful editor-y type, you know, sort of technically savvy person with a long-term career. But he's like, I don't know who I am anymore when I'm not on this thing. It's been so long. I have these ideas about what that might be like. But I'm so afraid of the disaster that was me beforehand, and the choices that I would make if I was back in that space again, that I'm not willing to go there. And so he said, well, maybe, you know, maybe for my 55th birthday or whatever, I'll, you know, try going off for a little while. But it was, you know, sort of a long, interesting conversation with him about that.
We also there's a person we don't know very well, but who people we know, who has... You know, with the antipsychotics, it's a very similar sort of situation where people who have serious psychotic issues start taking antipsychotics and can become more stable. And then after a while,
right.
Think, I'm fine. I seem fine. I'm not psychotic. I'm fine. I don't want to be taking this daily medication. I'm going to go off of this. But they're making that decision in a mind state which is not their baseline mind state. And then get to the other end to go off of the antipsychotics, become completely psychotic, and don't want to lose who they are in that position, and won't go back on the antipsychotics, which I totally understand. Nobody can, you know, it's hard, people can't, their friends can't convince them to go back on the antipsychotics because they become a different person, and they don't, right now, they lose themselves completely. It's a person who, you know, here you are, and you're like, oh, here, take this, and you'll become George. It's like, but I'm not George. But when you're George, you're George. But I'm not now, right? And so, imagining in the future the process of having, let's say, 10 or 50 or 100 times more selection and fine-tuned controls over that process. And, you know, I don't currently take daily medications that affect my mood and
caffeine,
personality.
Alcohol. Yeah, other than the usual.
Do not strongly take.
Don't talk to me until I've had my first cup of coffee.
Excluding the things I consider food.
But if I had the choice to take something which would make me just fine-tune control of that much calmer, happier, you know, I don't know, there's a whole wide range. Would I choose to do that? If I could take 10 things and I could fine tune those, it's like, oh, I'll just a little happier, a little more productive in the days, but then at night I can relax really well, and you know, and I'll really get along with people just that much better. Like, and I won't have fights anymore, you know. Why do we have, I don't want to have fights anymore. We can just tune that out of there. You know, do you do that? What does that mean? And are you still the same person? And how do you, you know, how do you know?
There's this whole, and where, I mean, one of the sort of things that I think is very clearly on the very near-term horizon, I mean, like not like this year or next year, but that there's such a huge market in the, within the current model, sort of the medicalization or the pathologization of normal state. So that, I mean, I think that really soon, if it hasn't already occurred, we're going to have sort of diagnosing of post-lunch nap disorder, sleepy, you know, sleepy disorder. You know, that people who, after, you know, sort of they get there at work at 9, whatever, they go to lunch at noon, they get back from work, and around 2, you know, they're losing their focus, they're unable to continue.
And so there's,
but I think
large dose of caffeine an hour after lunch.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you maybe want something a little different. For some reason you don't like lattes or something.
But you don't have time to leave your office to go get them.
You're not allowed.
Right.
Not allowed
to last longer because you can't actually redose, so it needs to last 8 hours instead of an hour.
You're an anti-technologist.
Well, they serve the net as the cure for that, right?
Yep, exactly.
They come back from lunch.
But that's an unproductive cure.
Oh, yes. Right. Their managers would prefer that they...
And then there's that whole realm of work drugs.
I wonder,
you know,
if the inefficiencies is built into these corporate structures where they just kind of... I mean, it seems like they don't know what they're really even doing anyway a lot of times.
That doesn't stop them.
Just handle a lot of stimulus.
May I answer that?
Sure.
Go.
It's not anti-technology per se. It's a suspicion from my study of the stimulants.
Okay.
That the stimulants ring a little more workout. Who's it doing that for? And it's not for free.
Jay,
it comes
Jay,
from someplace.
Could you sit more in the circle?
Bringing this extra bit of workout is the particular gift of the stimulants. But it's not free, and who's your bringing it out for? Your boss. I just remember these guys who would take the stimulants to go to work and they're wrecking their bodies to put in a couple extra hours for their boss.
A lot of writers
boss.
Go for the stimulants.
Yeah.
It's all, I love them. I love them myself. I'm just trying to add a little cautionary note that it may not be the free energy that it seems to be. And I think a nap room is more humanizing. It brings your dreams back to you. And I can't understand why management is so retrograde. They don't trust their employees to have a good fucking power nap. Bah!
A cube and a bed.
Yes.
It's already not free because the moment you start taking one of them, you lose yourself. That's the price of admission, right?
And if the point is, like you're saying, that you don't want to be yourself, okay, that's fine.
Right.
But then...
But should you address that first?
Well, how do you address that?
How do you address
that? I mean,
that leads a bit
into the other thing.
Change your mind as much as any drug.
Where is the
So that's the thing. So how much do people want or need meditation or yoga or a variety of other things that change their mindset without taking a psychoactive if they can fine tune with a what?
It takes effort and attention.
But it takes effort and attention.
Yeah, but hold on. For me, you see me do yoga every single morning because I know for me it's either that or it's an SSRI. Period.
Right.
Here or if we're at Health and
I'm at HEAR.
So you hear me.
So there is that. All right. But I mean, this is a conscious decision I made because doing all the yoga will also make you a different kind of person too, right? And you have to figure that out because I just somehow, I mean, and I think it's a Protestant thing, I would see it as a weakness almost.
To take
SSRI
every day. But I would guess that's going, I mean, that one generation, two generations that will be gone, mostly. Like there will still be, it'll be a smaller fringe who think that that's the case.
I know we're talking about sort of the future of these things being perfect and well-defined and things, but of course right now they're all really crude.
Right.
Yeah. They'll be better. That's the theory. The theory is they'll get better.
I mean,
the drugs suck.
Theory.
There's something about the ritual of the way that people are taking these pills and that it's a daily conscious decision to continue to every day be walking the path. It's not that the decision is made once.
Right.
And then you make a decision to go off.
Right.
You repeat the ritual of re-engaging with that decision.
Right.
Every day.
Yeah. Right. And for people who taking that pill on a daily basis significantly alters their personality, that was the case with the psychotic antipsychotic taking antipsychotics is that you miss it for a day and suddenly you're no longer the person who was choosing to take them anymore.
So I have an example that happened to me really recently. I was staying with friends and my friends were on very very strong but a sort of unusual brand of antidepressant medication. She lost it. And she lost it, all right?
Yeah.
Not because the drugs had worn off, but she basically went into an obsessive compulsive loop looking around her apartment for the drugs, which she found the next morning, all right? And just, she just put them in a slightly weird place, but this is it. So much of their self-identity was tied up in that. For it to be gone was a complete complete rupture.
I hadn't thought of that angle of like I am George. I like being George, but I've lost my pills, and I won't be George tomorrow.
That's right.
If I don't take it.
Always do yoga.
You know, I mean, it's actually an interesting question, and some sort of psychoactive isn't the only thing that does this. I had a long-term conversation with a woman. We were doing our a doctor work together, and she really wanted to have children, and she knew that once she had children, she was like, well, once I have kids, I know that I'm not going to think that this work that I'm doing now from a doctor is going to be that important. I'm going to think the kids are that important. Right now, I really think this work is important. So I don't really want to have the kids until I finish the work, because then I know that's going to change my mind. But I want to have kids, and so I don't know what to do. And we had this conversation for a couple of years, and then she had some kids. And she moved off to Boston to be near her family and did what people who have kids do, you know, and disappeared kind of, you know, out of my scope. And then she called me about a year later. I hadn't talked to her in a while, and she was like, so now I'm on the other side, and I realize that my kids are the most important thing, and that this is what my life is now, and I know I'm not going to finish my dissertation, and I'm that person now.
And it's okay with me.
I can't imagine how I ever would have thought that the dissertation was more important than this. This is clearly so important. I mean, and so she anticipated.
I felt the same way about opium.
We'll be deleting that from the podcast.
So then I think that the question of the subject who makes the decisions, or the subject who has the value, or the subject who you become or who you occupy is a very interesting one. And that is something that's shifting more and more and more.
And I'd like to just put a little critical eye on this idea of baseline.
Good. No good thing.
And I try and get at this a little bit when I talked about ground state, but baseline is good. I mean, what is the baseline? I mean, is the way we are here, is this our baseline? Is the way that we are in a culture that is basically pathological and schizophrenic, is the way we adjust to that, is that our baseline? If we move to a different environment, your mind changes, your body changes, your chemistry changes, and the way you feel and relate to people changes. Is that your baseline? So, is adjustment to a culture that is sick at its core
really a good baseline, right? Except that if you are living in that culture that is sick and you know,
one
then,
could
then
argue that
that's what you got.
Baseline
what you
got. Really is only a period from birth until imprinting starts, which is a very tiny time period. Because you know, once you've started imprinting on whatever your culture is, you're off baseline.
I think assuming you are different from your culture and your environment.
My experience of my sort of self is I've never actually been surfing, so this is, you know,
do with this as you will.
Surfing metaphor for non-surfer. I've ridden waves, let's put it that way. But just sort of, it's not, there's no single me it's a continuous kind of balancing of sort of as things move along, and I'm confronted with stuff, and sort of who I am is definitely the sort of moving target.
Society of mind.
What then?
Minsky called it the society of mind.
Society of mind.
Well, so maybe it's baseline is this whatever mode is allowing you to most conserve the legacy
more of,
all of the things that comprise
yourself.
Could
it be also the choices
maximal
that we make
legacy
of ours? Like the actual...
Thank you.
The navigation, like Marx, what does cyber mean, like etymologically?
A governor, but it means governor in the sense that the steersman. Cyber.
Yeah, maybe, like,
it comes
maybe
from
that,
the original term is from like a helmsman.
Cybernema.
Yeah, so it's just sort of
maybe this like this sort of
steering the boat.
More and more fine-tuned or complex control that we have over our minds and work that we've always had or always have, you know, that keeps us going from one moment to the next, and just choosing which moment to have might be a kind of baseline.
Right.
I liked what Dale did with this this possibility of the ground state. So, like, testing the proving of it, asking yourself, like, you know, is this ground state training, trying these things and playing off the different aspects of the consciousness, different allies, different experiences, different you in a height of passion, you know, or you under great duress, or you in a state of lax boredom after work at a boring job you don't really care about, but you're there because you've got to score some money, and, you know, all these different modalities of being, that there's an opportunity for you to play them off of each other, to ironize against one against the other, and try to find this ground state for yourself that's a part of your thing, but it doesn't exist for anybody before that, right?
Right, and this is exactly it. The thing that the postmodernists have given us is this idea that the norm, the idea of the norm, is completely constructed by the culture you're in.
Yeah.
That idea is going to take probably another 100 years to really sort of work its way into the roots and wheels.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to come much faster. That's the problem with that idea. That it's very easy to exploit by anyone. So that post-modernity feeds perfectly well into, like, the Bush phantasm.
I mean, the faith-based reality.
There's this amazing line in some... I'm just going to have to paraphrase it, but it was someone was interviewing somebody who was a media person in the Bush administration.
Yeah, the faith-based reasoning thing.
And they were like... And the Bush guy was, to the interviewer, said, "Oh, you're still one of those people who believes that reality's out there.
Yeah.
You believe that we can construct reality." So once you make that move, which in some sense is the we co-create or construct our own reality move, then, like, all bets are off. So
until the wheels fall off.
You don't need the postmodernists to critique the idea of norm.
I agree with you.
Paul Shepherd called deconstructionism the intellectual wing of the theme park movement.
Right, but those
it's a throwdown.
Dale,
you and me.
It's negative
post-structuralism too. So, and they're all reading each other. I mean, Clifford Geertz is reading all the postmodernists.
Yeah.
I mean, who cares? Let's lose that word.
He's a piece of shit.
he always says that. I love it. So we don't.
but I mean, that's the thing. Since we have lost our moorings to the normative fairly rapidly, then it really isn't about who I was. It really isn't about returning to the norm. It's about literally much more intentionally, who do I want to be today?
Yeah, that's
what I'm saying.
But what's difficult about it is that kind of intensifies the somewhat uncomfortable split between the chooser and the content of the personality. So all of the places where we're used to feeling comfortable, which even if they're sort of uncomfortable sometimes, is like, you know, the waves of affects, our habits, our traditions, where we come from, the patterns of our thinking. And suddenly when those things are kind of up for grabs, it introduces not only the fact that we are making these decisions and what does that say about who we are, but it also puts intensity, it puts a strange pressure on this chooser. Who is this chooser?
Right.
And what I think it does is it sets in motion a somewhat apocalyptic process where you can no longer really sustain a kind of identity
right.
with the content
right.
of personality or consciousness in a kind of experiential day-to-day sense. And so you're sort of driving this weird overmind, which may be pathological, or it may be transcendental, or some confusion of the two. I mean, that was
buy the ticket.
My mystical experience was like, there's something in me that has nothing to do with my personality at all. And it's in some ways intrinsically me, but it's also a little creepy. It's kind of inhuman. It's kind of out of the game. And there's a way in which we're kind of, what's that?
Which gets us back to Steven.
Yeah.
But couldn't you really say some of that also about like a psychedelic experience? I mean, like
making
the decision to make a choice to alter your personality for a period of time, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, it's, I mean, that's I think, absolutely the moment of terror that comes when you pop something in your mouth, is that it's irrevocably changing itself.
Right.
I think the idea that there's a split between the camp of people who may be altering themselves in a psychoactive way and maybe altering themselves in another kind of psychoactive way is really almost humorous, and the idea that there's... That if you choose to take a psychedelic substance and change your personality, your mind state, etc., that somehow is more, I don't know, righteous and holy. I like taking them.
And we like to take them every day,
comparatively speaking.
Well, certainly during your talk earlier, I was thinking as you were describing the personality people who have the experience of thinking that they're going to die and then at the last minute not dying and having themselves be very changed from that is very, very similar to the experience of a person who takes a psychoactive and has a very similar experience to dying and then coming back and not being dead, and it can be very life changing in that exact same way.
Stuart?
Kind of getting back to this baseline idea, is it possible to, can we consider that George, for instance, who has been taking antipsychotics for years or taking Prozac for 15 years, that is their new baseline? And
that is
as valid a baseline right. as the person they were before they started taking medicine.
I think that's the way we kind of have to
right, and I think that the desired personality becomes a moving target in a lot of ways, because George probably has things he'd change about himself as well.
Of course.
And so now he's aiming for a new baseline. Right, and maybe he's aiming for the original. I have no idea. You know, I mean, he could be like, oh, God,
I know what I said, but that was yesterday.
It's the classic thing of SSRIs where people say, often I feel like I'm myself now, like I wasn't before,
right.
and now I feel like I'm myself.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty common.
Right.
And that means that there's some inner sense of what
the baseline
should be.
Do you have a baseline before your first psychedelic experience?
That's
can you ever get that back again? And do you want to? I don't.
Some people certainly do, though.
Well,
certainly there are people who take a psychoactive and wish they hadn't.
Pull on my anchor.
Yeah, exactly.
Pull on my anchor.
All substances change.
Sure.
I mean, Eric and I had a conversation about this about 3 years ago, and one of the conclusions that we came to was, is it possible that the triggers that induce one to reach a state of psychosis, that the psychedelic drug use that I might have had in my late teens, you know, may have contributed to an eventual eruption of blah, 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 so on and so forth. Well, maybe.
Is it possible?
Would I take it back? Probably not. But
were they directly correlated? I mean, did he take it and have a rupture?
No. I had ruptures years later. But it's but that question comes into play.
Yeah, well, in an absence of direct causality,
what takes you away from a baseline in consensus reality where you begin to
sort of
the herd? You know, and if you're leading the herd through LSD, or you're
Daniel
the herd through some
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome.
Other kind of.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I mean, once you've already made the decision to step outside...
To alter your consciousness.
Right.
You're altering your consciousness, and you're altering
your
consciousness.
You're already agreeing not to accept norm.
And the baseline is already changing. You are experiencing changing the landscape of where you are, or your friend doing Prozac for 20 years. Why does he want to stop now? Due to side effect, perhaps?
I think it's more...
For him, it was really just like sort of that weird question of sort of like, a sensation that the ritual taking of this thing every day is a big part of his personality, and that he doesn't... It feels artificial to him in some way. It feels odd that this is who he is, that is a person who wakes up every day and takes the pills.
Well, it feels artificial, there is some other less artificial, more normal, more baseline that he would be if he...
And I wonder about this naive, like, I'm a different person and who am I? Because I've taken psychedelics, I experimented with SSRIs just to see what it would do to just the affectivity or different things, and they enhance other certain aspects. But I never was like, I'm a different person. I was like, I never wondered what kind of person I was before. I didn't care who I was afterwards. I can see it in terms of wanting to play with energy or affectivity or things like that, or enhancing this or that aspect of my consciousness. But I never had this quandary that it created for me. I mean, I very much have embraced, a sort of very impersonal idea of what a human being is anyway, so maybe that's why it was obviated.
You've already made the switch. You've already sort of incorporated the openness of the conscious subjectivity. Most people really have a tremendous amount of identity.
Yeah, most people I have it too. We all have it.
Well, we all have it, obviously. Right. I mean, it's not like I don't have it, but I never was like, I was like, what? I mean, who am I? I'm not.
Louder.
I was just saying, I think it's not sometimes even psychoactive drugs that can do that to you.
Right.
I think it's, for some people, taking iron.
Right.
It's hard to do that with
yeah. Oh, yeah, energy-wise, definitely.
You're incredibly grumpy, and that's not
me. Incredibly grumpy is a very nice way to put it.
Stuart?
Stuart, you said that you have had experimented with SSRIs,
right,
and they didn't necessarily make you feel like you were a different person. But my assumption, based on your use of the term experimentation, is that you don't need SSRIs on a daily basis to
it was extremely profound experience. It was the 80s. They started giving them away. My GP had a ton of it. I was kind of tired. I lived in India for a year. I was really bored to be back in America. I came back because I didn't want to like hang out and keep wandering around India either. I wanted to see what my story was here in America. I came back. I was really tired all the time. And he said, I got this fluoxetine, and I read the literature on it, and I thought, okay, let's just see what it does to my energy level. Let's see what it does. And it was it took two to three weeks to take an effect. I wasn't smoking any pot at that time, which I do smoke a lot of pot now, pretty much every other day or every day. I can't do it in the daytime. Because I have to focus on my work and I can't focus. But I like to get high. I don't drink any alcohol. I don't like alcohol.
SSRI is the gateway drug.
But let me explain to you, because it was really interesting. So I noticed, 2 weeks, I noticed an enhancement of my senses. Like I was tripping a little, but I wasn't. It was very lucid. It was almost like I had been sitting Zen, and I had sat a lot of Zen and stuff like that, or sitting, whatever, sitting, just sitting down. And like I had been sitting session or something. I call them, as opposed to high drugs, because I'm curious about all these reuptake inhibitors, I call them plateau drugs. And what it does is it puts you on a plateau. It's not a high, it's very subtle. Wait, let me finish. It's very subtle.
Didn't let me finish.
No, I'm sorry. But okay.
Go down. You're going. Go.
But so like, yeah. What it did? It didn't soften. It was. So all these mind states that perhaps were a little grabbier before were less grabby to me. And then after 3 months, I tapered it off. And actually, a lot of the stuff that I
the intensity or whatever that I got, the new grooves that I was working on. It was like an extended psychedelic, similar kind of stuff. It was there, you know, it was integrated into my life. So I stopped and that was it.
Okay, so then, I mean, if you took this substance for several weeks and gained this new experience...
It wasn't new necessarily, it was just plateau.
You were describing experiencing reality differently than you had previously.
It was like being high, but on a plateau. Like, yeah, like if I dropped acid, I would notice an intensity.
I'm not going to try anymore.
Okay. We have to wrap up, I think.
Yeah.
So I was going to say
there ought to be some objective criteria for ascertaining what is an evolutionary change of the baseline. I mean, we all know it's...
So you give them an MMPI or something every couple of weeks.
You should have choice to try different things, but you still want to know if... You know, you see your friend really enjoying smoking meth. Yeah. He loves it. He thinks it's great. But his body's going to hell. His family life is...
Right. Seems like a baseline he wouldn't have chosen.
It's a good
wouldn't
to
want.
Compile, like as Eric was talking about, the chooser should have some good guidelines to do the choosing.
Right.
And they ought to be documented somehow.
Mm-hmm. The meth user is totally valuable, though, in that, like, you know, as far as the rest of us, we get to compile his experiences and know which road not to go down.
In 2003, I went to two conferences back-to-back. I went to the American Psychiatric Association Conference in Moscone Center in San Francisco, and the following weekend I went to the Mindscapes Conference in Berkeley, California. These two groups of people were both talking about the same kinds of things. Brain chemistry here, brain chemistry here. This brain chemistry over here is to make George not a psycho, so that he can work in a gardening store and have a normal life. This conversation over here about brain chemistry is about, we're going to treat this chemical and this molecule and this diode here so that we can have this kind of psychedelic experience. The fact that these two camps are not speaking to each other is criminal.
Yeah.
Because they have so much to offer each other in terms of what totally different goals, totally different perspectives, but the same glossy posters of the brain. they're making it up. I mean, the brain science is so new. And so we're looking at these things, we're going, dopamine does this, and serotonin does this, and, you know, this does this, and this does that, and tweak this molecule. They're making it up right now. So it's the idea that these two camps aren't having a conversation that's really about solving each other's problems. It's just terrible.
Some wrapping up thoughts. I think that one of the things that most everyone kind of agreed on was that the concept of the baseline is sort of a moving, you know, complicated function.
Different inputs, moving and complicated.
And that the nature of sort of the chooser and sort of is an ongoing process rather than just sort of this a very simple thing. And that's kind of the point, is that right now, he's correct that brain science is still pretty unable to predict what a drug will do once you actually start giving it to humans regularly in a
certainly
reliable
way. In any
way.
Given human.
And, yeah. Especially in any given human. But we are, you know, the science continues to move. The ability to actually track the effects of blocking or agonizing one receptor is way up from the last. I mean, 10 years is huge, huge changes.
And it's only getting started.
And it's only really getting started. And the market is huge. It's very obvious to me that you have an enormous world full of people who would like to be able to change how they feel. You know, whether it's, you know, the 2 p.m. sleepies or get more done or get more rested or whatever, people will buy those products. People will take those products. People will buy the product illegally if they need to. And I think it's a real big open question that I don't feel like is, I don't feel like I have a really good understanding of, even though I talk to a lot of people who think about it, is what do you do about the fact that, you know, you can have like a spice rack. I mean, this is the dream I've had since I, you know, sort of started becoming involved with studying this field is, you know, you go into your bathroom or whatever, you're safe, you know, whatever, keep your friends out of it, but maybe. But you've got the spice rack. It's, you know, you go a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I'd like a little more creativity and a little sense of wonder.
What are we having for lunch, darling?
Right, exactly. Maybe some, some basil and some, you know, sparklies, you know. And the sort of the sense
please
of
pass the
wonder with a side of contentment.
Right. Yeah. That the future, you know, sort of what oh my brain is so bad. The people we upload ourselves, people.
Extravians.
And what else we call them?
Transhumanists.
Transhumanists, good. That's the word I was trying to think of.
Us.
Oh right. The future, the idea of sort of the leap. I mean, Mark mentioned them, the technological
singularity.
People, it's nice to have someone else doing my
brain
thinking for
memory
me. But the singularity people sort of talking about sort of you not being able to see past this development of technology, which gets to a point which feeds on itself in a way that we really can't predict what comes after some layer there. I think that's something that's really going on in terms of mind sciences and psychoactive, both technologies, medicines, and practices and things like that. Just the question of who we are individually and collectively is really very much open, I think. Say something.
That's it.
Oh, wait, so one point.
No.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Tomorrow.